Can you guys hear me okay? Yeah. My name is LaTanya McQueen, and I am the moderator today for Leading Lives in Bondage or Free. And I would like to welcome you all on behalf of Virginia Humanities, producer of the Virginia Festival of the Book. I'm excited to introduce to you today these authors who are going to read for you excerpts of their fascinating and important work. The readings also will be followed by a Q&A, but there are a couple of things that I want to mention before we begin. Reminder, if you could, to please silence or turn off your cell phones. Also, if you decide to tweet about this event, of which it's appreciated, please use the hashtag VABookFest. This festival is free of charge, but not of cost. We hope that you will go online to give back or pick up a giving envelope from the information desk at the Omni and support this festival to help sustain it for many more years to come. We also encourage you to fill out a program evaluation. I think they've passed them out as you've been coming in. These provide useful information that help keep the festival free and open to the public. You can fill out a paper evaluation before you leave or complete one online at vabook.org. vabook.org/survey. And then also too, please support festival authors and our local booksellers by purchasing a book today if you haven't already. All of the authors' books are available for book signing after the program. After the readings and presentations, there's going to be a Q&A. For those of you who don't feel comfortable holding a microphone or speaking, I'm going to pass out some index cards and some pencils so you can write questions down, and then I can take them up. Or if you prefer, I can also, too, for those who do want to ask their question personally, I'll go around and pass out the mic. So it'll be a combination of both of those. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. Each of these books brings to life important narratives of African-American men and women that have gone unnoticed and unheard. First, we're going to have Christina Proenza Coles, author of American Founders. Conventional histories of North America have focused almost exclusively on white Europeans, rarely showing the leading roles African figures have figured into history. With American Founders, she introduces to us previously unknown black explorers, conquistadors, settlers, soldiers, sailors, entrepreneurs, generals, cowboys, pirates, and professors to show the ways African-descended people have played key parts in every stage of the nation's evolution. Christina Proenza Coles holds a dual doctorate in sociology and history from the New School for Social Research. She has been an assistant professor of the Atlantic World and African Diaspora at Virginia State University. She will be at the Atlanta History Center on June 15th. She also has an article that just came out recently, the title of which is Freedom Seekers, and it was recently published in Laffam's Quarterly. Please join me in welcoming Christina Proenza Coles.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm going to read some excerpts from American Founders, and I'd like to also show a few slides, hopefully. Could we do it? Thank you, perfect. So these are about 200 images that are just a few among the many that are in the book, that are talked about in the book, and so I'm going to read you some excerpts as you are invited to look at these images. Historical narratives shape how we imagine our place in the world. In the past, much American historiography has limited African Americans to a few roles, usually related to slavery or the civil rights movement, and gives the impression that mainstream history is the patrimony of white people. However, if we turn up the lights on our history, it becomes evident that people of color were there at every point, and not just as passive observers. The distinction between American history and African American history is imaginary. American Founders explores three themes that refigure traditional conventions of American history. First, slaves were Americans, irrespective of whether their citizenship rights were recognized by the state, who participated widely and meaningfully in the ordinary and watershed events that comprise the history of the Americas. Enslaved individuals were instrumental to the initiation and course of virtually every major New World historical event before the demise of slavery, itself an epic revolution, abolition that is, in which slaves played substantial roles. Second, in the era that preceded the formal abolition of American slavery, not all black people were enslaved. Despite the ubiquity of slavery, free people of color who were born free, won freedom because of military service or familial relationships, purchased their own freedom, secured it in the courts, or most commonly liberated themselves through flight, abounded throughout the Americas and contributed greatly to their development in myriad ways. The third theme undergirds the first two. Black and white Americans not only share the same New World history, they share the same ancestry. Enslaved and free people of color frequently had European relatives whose descendants became both black and white Americans. Slavery is no aberration of American history. It is the foundation of American history. However, American history and African American history, though inextricable and founded on slavery, cannot simply be reduced to slavery. Africans and their descendants preceded the English in settling what would become the United States. This book chronicles many of the ways in which Afro-American men and women helped to found and develop not just the U.S., but the Americas as a whole, by forming communities, continually undermining and ultimately eradicating New World slavery, and championing universal citizenship. Until 1820, Africans outnumbered Europeans coming to the New World by a ratio of 4-1. In the early 16th century, people of African descent accompanied European expeditionaries in virtually every exploratory and military New World campaign from Canada to Chile, inaugurating an unbroken tradition of black military service in the Americas. 17th century Afro-Americans continued to establish, develop, and defend towns and settlements throughout the Americas. As explorers, soldiers, settlers, cowboys, pirates, priests, proprietors, agents, artisans, rebels, and maroons. While revolts against slavery, from armed uprisings to legal challenges, began in the 1500s, in the early 18th century, there were significant military and legal actions for freedom. These black democratic insurgents paved the way for and shaped the national independence wars that started at the end of the century. In the 19th century, Afro-Americans actively negotiated the terms of citizenship during this critical period of nation building as military leaders, soldiers, lawyers, medical professionals, entrepreneurs, educators, journalists, artists, and as local and international activists. In the early 20th century, Afro-Americans continued to champion the American ideals of universal rights, equality, justice, and civic engagement through their endeavors and innovations in politics, law, academia, science, engineering, mathematics, medicine, business, journalism, and art. The events here cover virtually all of the modern period and the Americas as a whole. The fact that people of African descent were omnipresent and integral to this history means that each chapter covers a wide range of times and places. The vast number of individuals included here is overwhelming and deliberate. I encourage the reader to let the sheer weight of their number and their intricate connections to global currents of history compel us to rethink our own history, our national narrative, and our creation myths. These black men and women are not exceptions. They are our founders. Throughout the history of the Americas, people of African descent negotiated, risked their lives for, and realized their own freedom and that of others in myriad ways. Black women and men used the courts to petition for their own freedom on both sides of the Atlantic, and in doing so, they challenged and altered the legal frameworks of the institution of slavery. African Americans consistently capitalized on the outbreak of conflict to undermine slavery. This can be said of the many thousands of black militia members who earned their freedom and pursued upward mobility for their families in Latin American and Caribbean military units. This can be said of the thousands of maroon rebels, fugitive slaves, who seized and defended their freedom militarily as well. Black conquistadors and black pirates on opposite ends of the colonial spectrum both escaped slavery and claimed freedom and material advancement. People of color served in every military engagement throughout the Americas, including North America, in many cases gaining freedom for themselves, if not already free, and eroding the political economy of slavery. The American Revolution itself may be seen as part of a centuries-long process of emancipation in the United States, where black Americans sought freedom on both sides of the conflict. Thousands joined the Patriot Army, including James Armistead, an enslaved Virginian whose services as a double agent helped to foster the Yorktown victory. Many more African Americans recognized the promise of freedom offered to those who served in Loyalist companies. The vast ranks of men and women who left plantations to aid the British in exchange for their freedom made the American Revolution among the largest slave revolts in American history. African Americans' engagement in the Age of Revolution preceded and in some ways paved the way for the Declaration of Independence of 1776. Slave revolts and maroon communities were a continuous part of American life, de facto political movements that shaped the larger events of the Age of Revolution. South Carolina's Stono Rebellion and Jamaica's First Maroon War, just to take two examples, were their own declarations of independence that reverberated far beyond their locales. Throughout the Americas, Afro-Americans took up arms, both for and against the state, as patriots and royalists, maroons and militia, rebel slaves and regular army officers, in order to stake claims to rights. The language of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation itself shows that he understood that the military service of black Americans was essential to the democratic revolution that was the American Civil War. History has too often been misconstrued as something based on purity, when it is in reality based on interaction. Many of us have been conditioned to think of Americans in binary terms, black or white, slave or free, North or South, Anglo or Latin, us or them. But as it turns out, we are, and always have been, completely intertwined. Arguably, the first documented slave owner in the U.S. was a black man. Anthony Johnson was certainly among the first in any case. On the other hand, the nation's earliest documented slave, John Punch, sired a long lineage of white Americans, one of whom begat the first black president of the U.S., Barack Obama. Historians may debate the paternity of fair-skinned slaves on the plantations of the nation's first presidents, but that they, along with innumerable enslaved Americans, had significant European ancestry is beyond question. You'll notice that many of the portraits here, the individuals have European ancestry, which says something about the insidious violence of the color line that cleaved Americans apart. Until the first quarter of the 19th century, the vast majority of Americans arrived in the New World as slaves. Americans today are the descendants of slaves and slave owners, both literally and figuratively. Men and women of African descent have fundamentally shaped American history since 1492 and made massive contributions to the formation of the Americas in every possible way. The men and women presented in these pages should encourage us to think more deeply about what we Americans mean when we say we, or Americans. Americans of African descent who fought for freedom helped to liberate all Americans from circumscribed conceptions of citizenship. Seeking and defending the ideals of liberty and justice, even in the midst of slavery and discrimination, African Americans were crucial to the founding of the modern world and the rise of democracy. We will not understand American history until we understand African American history and recognize that it is not solely a story of oppression, though oppression is a continuous and extremely dangerous current against which people of African descent have had to contend, but also that black people were among the architects of our nation and the principal founders of the Americas at large. Black Americans continuously encouraged the United States to live up to the ideals enshrined in its founding documents. Afro-Americans were also innovators and pioneers, visionaries and scientists who overcame the constraints of racism to make enormous contributions, not just to American history, but to humanity. Multiculturalism is not politically correct. It is historically accurate. We undermine ourselves and our society with segregated binary frames of reference cultivated by traditional history, erroneous conventions that shape how we think about history and understand race that are not just the result of the obvious malevolent kinds of racism that are easy to identify. Perhaps more insidious are the assumptions shaped by the subtleties of how we consciously and unconsciously understand ourselves and how we fit into the world around us. Thank you.
Christina. Next, we have Saidiya Hartman, author of Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, a social history that examines a generation of young Black women who rebelled against traditional social and cultural constraints. Hartman is a Guggenheim Fellow and the author of Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route, and also Scenes of Subjection. Hartman has been a Coleman Fellow and Fulbright Scholar, is a professor at Columbia University, and lives in New York. Please join me in welcoming Saidiya Hartman.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. So I'll just start out reading, and then maybe in the Q&A, we can talk more about, the account of intimate revolution or a minor revolution that I narrate in the book. So I'll read a few pages from the beginning. This is from The Terrible Beauty of the Slum. And I'm good, you can hear me? Is it too loud, or is it going? Okay. You can find her in the group of beautiful thugs and two fast girls congregating on the corner and humming the latest rag, or lingering in front of Wanamaker's and gazing lustfully at a pair of fine shoes displayed like jewels behind the plate glass window. Watch her in the alley passing a pitcher of beer back and forth with her friends, brash and lovely, in a cut-rate dress and silk ribbons. Look in awe as she hangs halfway out of a tenement window, taking in the drama of the block and defying gravity's downward pull. Step onto any of the paths that cross the sprawling city and you'll encounter her as she roams. Outsiders call the streets and alleys that comprise her world the slum. For her, it is just the place where she stays. You'd never happen onto her block unless you lived there too, or had lost your way, or were out on an evening lark seeking the pleasures yielded by the other half. The voyeurs on their slumming expeditions feed on the lifeblood of the ghetto, long for it and loathe it. The social scientists and the reformers are no better with their cameras and their surveys, staring intently at all the strange specimens. Her ward of the city is a labyrinth of foul alleys and gloomy courts. It is Africa Town, the Negro Quarter, the Native Zone. The Italians and Jews, engulfed by proximity, disappear. It is a world concealed behind the facade of the ordered metropolis, the not yet dilapidated buildings and decent homes that face the street hide the alley tenement where she lives. Entering the narrow passageway into the alley, one crosses the threshold into a raucous, disorderly world, a place defined by tumult, vulgar collectivism, and anarchy. It is a human sewer populated by the worst elements. It is a realm of excess and fabulousness. It is a wretched environment. It is the plantation extended into the city. It is a social laboratory. The ghetto is a space of encounter. The sons and daughters of the rich come in search of meaning, vitality, and pleasure. The reformers and sociologists come in search of the truly disadvantaged, failing to see her and her friends as thinkers or planners, or to notice the beautiful experiments crafted by poor Black girls. The ward, the bottom, the ghetto, is an urban commons where the poor assemble, improvise the forms of life, experiment with freedom, and refuse the menial existence scripted for them. It is a zone of extreme deprivation and scandalous waste. In the rows of tenements, the decent reside peacefully with the dissolute and the immoral. The Negro quarter is a place bereft of beauty and extravagant in its display of it. Moving in and moving on establish the rhythms of everyday life. Each wave of newcomers changes the place, how the slum looks and sounds and smells. No one ever settles here, only stays, waits for better, and passes through. At least that is the hope. It is not yet the dark ghetto, but soon only the Black folks will remain. In the slum, everything is in short supply except sensation. The experience is too much. The terrible beauty is more than one could ever hope to assimilate, order, and explain. The reformers snap their pictures of the buildings, the kitchenettes, the clotheslines, and the outhouses. She escapes notice as she watches them from the third floor window of the alley house where she stays, laughing at their stupidity. They take a picture of Lombard Street when hardly no one is there. She wonders what fascinates them about clotheslines and outhouses. They always take pictures of the same stuff. Are the undergarments of the rich so much better? Is cotton so different than silk and not as pretty draped like a banner across the streets? The outsiders and the uplifters fail to capture it, to get it right. All they see is a typical Negro alley, blind to the relay of looks and the pangs of desire that unsettle their captions and hint at the possibility of a life bigger than poverty, at the tumult and upheaval that can't be arrested by the camera. They fail to discern the beauty, and they see only the disorder, missing all the ways Black folks create life and make bare need into an arena of elaboration. A half-dressed woman wearing a house coat over a delicate nightgown leans against the doorway, hidden by the shadows of the foyer, as she gossips with her girlfriend standing at the threshold. Intimate life unfolds in the streets. The journalists from Harper's Weekly gush in print, quote, above the Jews in the same tenement houses, amid scenes of indescribable squalor and tawdry finery, dwell the Negroes leading their lighthearted lives of pleasure, confusion, music, noise, and fierce fights that make them a terror to white neighbors and landlords alike, end quote. Aroused at the sight of elegantly clad domestics, janitors and stevedores, elevator boys in rakish hats preening on the corner, and aesthetical Negroes content to waste money on extravagance, ornament, and shine, the sociologist urges them to learn the value of a dollar from their Jewish and Italian neighbors. Negroes must abandon the lax moral habits, sensual indulgence, and careless excess that are the custom of slavery. The present past of involuntary servitude unfolds in the street and the home, which was broken up completely by the slave ship and the promiscuous herding of the plantation, is now broken again, broken open in its embrace of strangers. The senses are solicited and overwhelmed. Look over here. Let your eyes take it all in. The handsome thugs lining the courtyard like sentinels, the immoderate display of three lovely flower pots arranged on the sill of a tenement window, the bed sheets, monogrammed handkerchiefs, embroidered silk hose, and whore's undergarments suspended on the line across the alley, broadcasting clandestine arrangements, wayward lives, carnal matters. Women with packages tied in paper and string flit like shadows, The harsh light at their backs transforms them into silhouettes. Abstracted dark forms take the place of who they really are. The rag seller's daughters idle on the steps that descend to their cellar flat. The eldest is resplendent, sitting amid the debris in her Sunday hat and soil frock. The youngest remains mystery and blur. The sun pours down the stairwell, pressing against the girls and illuminating the entrance to the small dank room, which is filled with the father's wares, rags, papers cast off, piecework and discarded objects salvaged for future use. He turns his back to the camera and eludes capture. What you can hear if you listen, the guttural tones of Yiddish making English into a foreign tongue, the round, open-mouthed sounds of North Carolina and Virginia bleeding into the hard-edged language of the city and transformed by the rhythm and cadence of northern streets, the eruption of laughter, the volley of curses, the shouts that make the tenement walls vibrate and jar the floor, the sweet music of an extended moan that hushes the ones listening, eavesdroppers wanting more despite knowing they shouldn't, the rush of impressions, the musky scent of tightly pressed bodies dancing in a basement saloon, the inadvertent brush of a stranger's hand against yours as she moves across the courtyard, a glimpse of young lovers huddled in the deep shadows of a tenement hallway, the violent embrace of two men brawling, the acrid odor of bacon and hoe cake frying on an open fire, the honeysuckle of a domestic's toilet water, the maple smoke rising from an old man's corncob pipe. A whole world is jammed into one short block, crowded with black folks shut out from almost every opportunity the city affords, but still intoxicated with freedom. The air is alive with the possibilities of assembling, gathering, congregating. At any moment, the promise of insurrection, the miracle of upheaval, small groups, people by themselves, and strangers threaten to become an ensemble, to incite treason en masse. So I'll read a little snippet from another section, and then I will sit down. So I'll just read the beginning of a portrait of a young girl, Maddie Nelson, arriving in New York City in the fall of 1917. It was still too early for the whores, sissies, and toughs who plied their trade at the docks. Families gathered, awaiting daughters and brothers and cousins. Thugs and gangsters lurked at the outskirts of the crowd, on the lookout for naive young women in search of direction or in need of help with a heavy piece of luggage. When Maddie Nelson arrived in New York City, she was barely a woman at 15. She was a tall, thin, dark-skinned girl, the kind only a father would have ever described as lovely, and the kind white people labeled a negress to make apparent their contempt and scorn. It would be a decade before the thick hair tamed in braids and pinned in a bun on the top of her head, prominent cheekbones, almond-shaped eyes, and wide, full lips would be compared to the beauty of an African mask. Even when dressed in her Sunday best, Maddie was decidedly unsophisticated, yet despite the not quite polished picture the black but comely small town girl presented, Maddie was determined to be more than nothing. It was hard for Maddie to make a distinction between the city and freedom itself. Like those provincials and fools whom Paul Laurence Dunbar derided in The Sport of the Gods as intoxicated by the subtle and insidious wine of the streets, who translated the Bowery into romance, made Broadway into lyric, and Central Park into a pastoral, and thereby failed to read the city as it really was, or apprehend it in a mode commensurate with its dangers, or properly adjust to its rhythms and demands. Maddie, looking past the cold facts and the risk, mistook the city for a place where she might thrive. The real fever of love would take hold of her, and the streets and the dance halls did become her best friends. All the sentimental causes for this rush and flight, the freedom to move, the want of liberty, the hunger for more and better, and the need of breathing room, explained her presence in New York. She too would fall prey to the pleasures and dangers of the city while trying to make a feast of its meager opportunities. Herman Hawkins was her first friend in New York. He worked as a waiter in a boarding house not far from where she lived with her mother. At 25 years old, he appeared worldly to the not yet 16-year-old Maddie, who by her own admission knew nothing at all, but was eager to learn. Herman boasted that he would show her everything, the Tenderloin, Harlem, Coney Island. He was a recent migrant from Georgia, so no doubt he enjoyed showing Maddie his city. Maddie looked forward to the evening spent with her gentleman friend. They would go to dance halls and parties where couples did the slow drag, the funky butt, and fishtail, to rags played on player pianos, and ditties and love and trouble songs the white world called coon songs. One night after such a party, they were walking home through Allen Park when Herman started talking about the things he wanted to do to her. Maddie did not know if he started talking this way because of how they had been dancing when the lights were dimmed, wrapped up so tight in each other that the boundary between her body and his gave way to flesh, or if the seclusion of the park in the early hours after midnight encouraged him to speak to her like she was a woman, like she was his woman, like she was the kind of woman who enjoyed listening to that kind of talk. In hot pursuit of the virginal but curious Maddie, Herman described in explicit detail what a body could do and how it would make her feel. Maddie had never done any of those things before, and she tried to picture the intimate acts he described and the sensations aroused by such acts, and wondered if she would be embarrassed with her bloomers down around her ankles, and what his body would feel like on top of hers, and if the bed sheets would be clean, or if the cot would speak when they made love. It wasn't right for Herman Hawkins to say such things. He had never spoken to her like this before. No one had. Maddie told him to stop, and yet he continued to talk, and she continued to listen. She knew what he was saying was bad, but it also sounded thrilling. He kept on talking as if she had not asked him to stop, and instead of getting angry or upset, she just listened. Maddie was not aware that she was giving him an answer to his question, and that she had said yes. Shortly after that walk in Allen Park, he convinced Maddie to remove her camisole and bloomers. It is not difficult to imagine the things Herman Hawkins taught Maddie inside the rented room of a lodging house. There were so many lessons to teach a girl who knew nothing, so much for her to discover what to do, how to hold him, how not to be embarrassed by her naked body or ashamed of her smells and the things she wanted to do. First, she had to breathe deeply and let go of the body, armored in anticipation of insult and attack. Surrender in consequence of pleasure. Allow the body to yield to another, to be entered, joined, and bridged, to risk all defense, yet not be made into the mule of the world. Thank you.
Lastly, we have Damaris Hill. Damaris Hill is the author of A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African-American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. Combining her poetry with the inclusion of biographical clips and archival photos, Hill reflects on Black women throughout history, ranging from those we know, like Fannie Lou Hamer, Eartha Kitt, and Ida B. Wells, to those lesser known who resisted violent racism and misogyny through any means they knew how to do. A writer and academic, Dr. Hill currently serves as an assistant professor of creative writing and African American and Africana studies at the University of Kentucky. Please join me in welcoming Damaris Hill.
Thanks so much. I'm going to open by reading portions of the memoir, and then I'm going to go into the the poetries, excuse me. The afflicted pray for healing, just as hungry people pray for bread. But when has God ever sent bread? In my recollections of the scriptures, God has always sent a woman like Eve, the unnamed woman that preceded her, a woman like Moses' mother, Jacobed, and a woman that raised him to be a king, Bethia, a woman like Deborah, and her skull-piercing homegirl, Jael, maybe some manna, but when has God ever sent bread? The poet Lucille Clifton advises me to study the masters, and in this way, my work reflects the historical lineage of resistance and my deep study of writers such as Phyllis Wheatley, Anna Julia Cooper, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, Gwendolyn Brooks, Toni Morrison, Zora Neale Hurston, and others. In kind, my work does not ignore the literary inheritance of other writers like Henry David Thoreau, Walt Whitman, Ernest Hemingway, and James Baldwin. Using history as inspiration, my work is immersed in a profoundly American tradition. This tradition explores the reality of the American condition and is in dialogue with democracy. Like history, I am older than I look. My white ancestors immigrated to this country in the 1780s. My African ancestors were already here. My mother is in labor with me in 1974. She and my father wished for a son they thought would unite them. I came, a woman in the body of a girl, 3.5 weeks late, breaking my mother in too many ways. She hadn't the energy to name me. My father was too lazy to be original. He scribbled my mother's name on a certificate and wrote the name of his mother right behind the wife's name. This ritual of naming is one way we learn to love and to bind with people who no longer share the planet with us. In these poems, the legacy of these women's lives chases me like a strong wind. The book is a love letter to women that have been denied their humanity. Most of these women have been forgotten, shunned, and/or erased. Every time I call the name of a woman in this book, presumed that she is loved. If you are brave, imagine that woman's name congealing on my tongue. Give the names breath and memory. Let these women dance among your days and with your nights. Dream better lives. So I'm going to open up the poetry reading with a poem to my grandmother, Harriet Beecher Sproul Hill. I believe this saying that the spirit of the first mother comes through the body of the second. So I believe that the spirit of the grandmother is always born in the granddaughter through the body of the mother. And this is an articulation of that. For those of us that are into history, my grandmother is a Sproul and a descendant of the Somerset Place, Collins Plantation, just short of the Dismal Swamp in Virginia. And it was one of the first plantations that was made a historical marker as early as the 1920s and 30s. Shut Up in My Bones, for Harriet Beecher Sproul Hill. I have the racket of anxiety in my genes. It rivets in ink. Despite this, I leave these marks. This evidence of us undone. In wit's end, it all ferments, and we shape totems of shame from our amusements. The musk of my imagination is as redolent as any untamed woman, and likewise mistaken for mental illness. Perfection is a mask, a perfume in my pulse. I learn to hide what is feared. To be literate is to pen oneself with needles, to shape beauty from a funhouse mirror. This is how artists learn the craft of display. Call this confession a lie and look closer. I stub my toe, tightrope walking the lashes of circus clowns. Only the liberated can see the legacies of bondage stirring beyond the ribbons. I have come to know I'm the savory morsel in America's teeth. These words are clawed into the enamel. My face is familiar among the haints, and I wear her likeness like a call. See, I had a grandma who could read lightning speeds, and now she's some Holy Ghost. The best life had for her was this country's secondhand soldier, a loving husband, no room for books and babies at the breast. The sanctified think marriage is a type of reward if you are a second generation out of slavery color of coffee bean type of woman, and your hair is some black lacquer of unruly licorice that has branches that wave like echoes. Her teeth, whiter than seashells, her breath, the scent of tobacco, as narrow as a Carolina pine with the worries about the rage of white folks. She died gifting me her photos, the only stories she would write. At birth, her name becomes my velvet lush heirloom, tufted behind my mother's. It is costly to stay free and appear sane. I am she in the extravagant kind, a shimmy spilling from her buttons, the erotic unbridled, and a glimmer riding the golden. I am her shrill of laughter, clapping in doubt. Chaos is a coy friend. Curiosity is a coy friend. Chaos, my alter ego. I mistook a jagged molar for an ivory tower, and I ain't got the good sense God gave me to rot. So I think we're dealing with issues here on this panel of democracy and migration in terms of African Americans and their contributions to this country. So in this book, in chapter 2, I find inspiration from a historian, anthropologist, and sociologist, Dr. Kallianne Gross, and she wrote this book called Colored Amazons. And once I read Colored Amazons, I immediately shut the book and I used it as inspiration, and I wrote a number of poems based on these case studies that she did, but only 16 made it into the book. And so I wanna read at least one of these poems based on the research of Kallianne Gross. And this is the Concession of Annie Cutler. And so Annie Cutler was a woman, a black woman from Boston. She fell in love with a man. So she moved to Philadelphia, and she decided to work in a hotel in Philadelphia. And I think she was working there about 8 years, and she, you know, was invested in this relationship, thought it would result in marriage, and unfortunately he married someone else. And then he met his demise. I'd like to read a poem I wrote about her. So The Concession of Annie Cutler. And this is an epistolary poem. Dear Mama, I must go with night. I am hellbound. Bury me in a white box in my wedding gown. A remnant of disaster, this grief corsets my sorrows. Pinch and ball snag me in this bride's gown. The tongue I praise God with was laid upon Henry. Blasphemy, betrayal, my gown. Mama, I swallowed the bitter syrup of angels unborn. As he lingered around my nightgown, I sipped a tea of pemrol, primrose, and blue-black cohosh, donning this gown. Mother, I tasted the bitterness of three souls, unleavened sacrifices. My gown defiled, doused in blood, shame suffocates me like a bodice of this gown. Mama, bury me in a white box coffin, cover it in earth. Darkness has bequeathed this gown. Pulled to hell in passion's chariots, I will be radiant, veiled in vengeance, and singed scorn of this bride's gown, once white-laced adorned with pearls of piety, the rage smoldering beneath this gratuitous gown of rejection and the fallacy of Henry's promises. I am forsaken as his bride processes in her white gown, her lips plump with smiles and secrets that once belonged to me. She is a fine portrait of domesticity, framed and fringed in her gown. Round with his child, the glee of Henry, fury engulfs me. A picture of ruined antiquity. He abandoned Venus in a torn gown. Mama, I choose hell to be my grand ball of debauchery, and will stand honorably as the flames feast on my bride's gown. I, Annie Cutler, Juliet of Henry Knight, will kill him and myself in spite. Please bury me in a white box in my bride's gown. So I have other poems in here, and not all of the poems are about women that experience incarceration, but I use bound as like a multiple entendre. So not only am I meeting fettered or restricted or oppressed, but I also want to talk about the ways that we are bound to our past in terms of ancestors, to our futures, and to in terms of our children, bound in terms of demarcation and writing things down. But also in each of these poems, I'm trying to create a double helix of the way that oppression led to a type of bound that means to spring forward and what you do from that space. So it's important to acknowledge that. So let's read about one of my favorite homegirls, Zora Neale Hurston. And there are some people in this poem that you should know. Well, one person in this poem is Anne Spencer, and we know that she lived in Virginia, even though she was a Renaissance poet. The other person is Madison Grant, and he's the father of the eugenics movement and medical racism, and used science to reinforce the mythologies of social hierarchies. And the other person you should know is Oda Benga. And Oda Benga was a black man that was actually an actor and a thespian, but that was in with the chimpanzees at the Bronx Zoo. So we want to remember these three people as we talk about Zora. And we do know that Zora was not also a writer and an anthropologist, right? So I want you to kind of think about what it would be like for a young adult Zora to occupy all of this white male space that was constructed to presume that she as a woman and as an African American was less than a person. And yet she's standing here in the midst of all of this science, right? Zora Neale Hurston. Before the Bronx Zoo, Oda Benga boarded a ship, flipping a fish scale like a coin. The first shiny thing he'd seen since his family was murdered. Leopold's soldier still carries the finger of Oda Benga's daughter in his pocket to ward away evil. Remember him, the man in with the monkeys? Who can forget the way Benga grit his teeth? The way they resembled claws. Zora reads of him caged in the zoo the same year her mother becomes a ghost. Thick and wet with memories, Zora has a hard time keeping still. From Morgan in Baltimore to Howard in the district to Barnard near the Bronx, Oda Benga haunts her. In slides her rituals, the foldings of news clippings in with her lunch, reading the creases, mysteries draped in her palms. This odd communion, the cradles of hell always take the shape of a woman's lips. Using a looking glass made from a martini, Madison Grant traces Zora's square jaw. When she whispers about Ann Spencer and the thespian boarder, Benga, Grant's throat burns with curiosity. He considers this Zora and all that is alchemy. Is she the prophecy of stones, the fire within the dark sciences he conjures? Okay, so I'm gonna ask this question. What does my time look like? I'm on 5 minutes? All right, I have this thing with time. I have this thing with time. That may come up in a personal conversation, but I have a thing with time. All right, so I'm going to read about another woman that I respect and love. I'm going to read this poem that I've written to Harriet Tubman. We know that Harriet Tubman, of course, freed thousands and could have freed more if they knew they were slaves. But we also need to focus on the fact that Harriet Tubman, for me in this book, Harriet Tubman is an Elijah figure. And I say this because, so I'm the only one in my family that's not ordained. That's not an ordained minister. I know a lot about the Bible, but I'm just not that good of a Christian. I'm like another kind of Christian, you know. I'm like Christian plus, turn the tables over in the temple type Christian, you know, that type of Christian. But I know a lot about the Bible. And so Harriet Tubman and Assata Shakur and the mythological but still historical figure, Marie Laveau, they are all Elijah figures for me. And what I mean by Elijah is I mean Elijah the prophet is the only other person in the Bible that ascended to heaven. He did not die a violent death. He did not experience a human death. And I see Harriet Tubman and Assata Shakur also having parallel experiences and lives in this way. And what I learned from these two figures that I write about in my book is that democracy and ideas of liberation and freedom cannot happen piece and parcel. It's all or none. It's all or none. Harriet Tubman, after liberating her parents, started a nursing home for African Americans, and she got to die in that nursing home that she started for her parents. Do you know how remarkable that is? It's very remarkable. And I pray that Assata Shakur right now is sitting in Cuba, sipping on a drink, enjoying the most delicious music that she has ever heard, and either dancing with the prettiest woman or the most handsome young gentleman that she can find, and living her very best life. And so I respect these two figures. So Harriet Tubman, I wrote a number of poems for her, probably like 15, but none of them worked for me. And what I mean by work is the poem had to fit the content of the person, but also had to complement the context of their historical lives. So in the end, I decided on this triptych poem. And by a triptych, I mean that it's written in three parts, and each of these columns can be read individually as a poem. But it's also spaced so that you can begin the poem in any place, and it rang true to Harriet Tubman. And I did this because Harriet Tubman could never be found. You know, her pre-emancipation award price was $40,000, which is equivalent to $1,100,000 in 2014 when I stopped writing this book. Ironically, that same $1 million price tag was given for Assata Shakur's head. All right, Harriet is holy. Lick a thumb, hold hands to the wind. What is it about water, women? Take me, Miss Tubman, in tow. Her instructions make my mark. X, a river be as faithful as a daughter of Eve, a mother of Cain, her face a rainbow wonder, her smile a collection of stars and of springs. Between water, between women, be no mysteries. I know of no man stands waist deep and wet in these crossings. Mossy riverbeds like braille fold in her feet. This woman needs these sweet waters in her palms. Thousands call her Moses. Ask the stars. Even Jesus needed a John the Baptist with arms wide. Her, she in the intersections, she be revolver rescue. I'm going to read it in a different direction now. She be revolver rescue. She in the intersections. Her, with arms wide, a John the Baptist, even Jesus needed. Ask the stars, her Moses, call thousands in her palms. These sweet waters this woman needs. Fold in her feet like braille, mossy riverbeds, these crossings, waist deep and wet in stands. I know of no man, be no mysteries between water, between women. Of stars, of springs, a collection, her smile, a rainbow wonder, her face, mother of Cain, daughter of Eve, as faithful as a river be. X, my mark, her instructions, make, take me, Miss Tubman, in tow. Water, women, what is it about? Hold hands to the wind. Lick a thumb. So that is... Harriet Tubman, I have two more poems that I want to share with you. One is about Joanne Little. Some of us know who Joanne Little is because we're old enough. Some of us don't know who Joanne Little is. But Joanne Little was a black woman that was locked up in a county jail for a petty theft, like let's say like milk from the corner store. And while she was in there, she was raped daily at the edge of an ice pick from one of the guards in the prison. One day that guard met his demise at the end of that ice pick. And this is the poem about Joanne Little. But I also talk a lot about geography. And so the county that Joanne Little is from is, again, Washington County in North Carolina, the same place where my ancestors are from. And it's a bird sanctuary. So there's going to be a lot of imagery about birds in here for anybody who's interested in birds. Joanne Little. The wind in Washington County carries. No one keeps to themselves. Rumors, soil. A caterpillar looks like a worm, and a worm looks like a snake. And the fact is that everything that crawls ain't looking to be a butterfly. But why take a garden rake to a bird? It's no secret. Cops welcome a reason to kill anything. Ask the people they cage. Only crows bred in captivity collect things. Corvids, they say. Nature's compulsive hoarders. What is a jeweled ring in the beak of a thief? A confession. What they come to call a horde of crows? A murder. We are not the only ones to speak over our dead. How she carried on at her window, feeding the fowl first. This kept the guards in stitches. In the light of day, one jailer rakes the rails of her cell until they bleed mercy at the edge of his ice pick, the one he stores in the desk. Even when she calls, he enters. A man ever reach his dick for you? Between the bars, his hands forcing his worm forward, you running backwards, waving no, your fingers loose like laces, barricading what you see as precious. His whispers scrape the curve of Joanne's crooked beak, his semen a stain lifting in each of her feathers. I think I'm gonna end by reading one poem. The last chapter in this book is to my futures. It's to my son. My son was very involved in national politics for the past 8 years of his life. After Michael Brown, he began experimenting with cocaine. He was running 3 local Republican campaigns in the state that he lived in during the last presidential election. The result is he's currently battling an addiction. He was very post-racial before the last election. And so the last part of this book is about how I'm bound to my son and my futures. So I'm not gonna read all of the poems here. But I will read this poem that most of us understand if we have a little person in our lives that thinks they're gangster enough to try us, right? You know, if you've ever had to discipline a child that you love so much in the midst of their anger, you're like, oh my gosh, I can totally kill you right now. You don't even know that your mother's like a warrior. Like, you don't know. So this is about that. So Gabriel cast a knuckle. My son has always been fond of grand gestures. He admires the ways of the dandy angel Gabriel. And when my son blows his horn to signal that we are at war against one another, I weep for him. He doesn't know that he was birthed of a phoenix. He doesn't know how many times I tasted my own ashes and licked the lava wounds gilded. He sees weak and wrinkled. He is blind to the ways that time traces my face with histories. He is too young to know the measures, how he entered the earth, surfing the thick membranes of my pain, and how I pushed his side of myself through 3/4 of the way through the window and held him there to keep his eyes from bursting into pulp. The plaster of my womb has always been a potion the devil fears, and my son warns me about his anger. I smile, tasting the gusts he blows. He has begun dismissing me with his hands. I catch his knuckle in my lip. He is a child of privilege and is clueless to the ways that the ways my teeth shave ostrich shells. He wasn't there when I dragged my feet across the waters before creation. His unancient ears are deaf to my melodies. He doesn't recognize this poet's libretto and the nuanced ways I call everything into being. He is mistaken. My 7-rayed nimbus is not a halo or a lesser crown. So that's all. Thank you.
If you all could do me a favor and join me again in another round of applause for So we have time for some questions. I'm going to go around the room. I'll get the mic if anybody wants to ask a question. I also had the index cards, and I can come around and collect those too. I have questions as well. Or maybe I can start. I'll start with a question.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if you all each could talk about the impetus for writing each of these books. So that's kind of the first part of my question. And my second question to you is, I'm interested in the structure of each of these and how you went about organizing it. So if you could talk.
Maybe they should talk first because it was definitely a collaboration.
Do you want to start?
No, I don't.
So basically, you're asking about the formal strategies of the book, LaTanya? So I think, like both of my, co-panelists, I mean, I feel like we're all involved in these critical archival engagements and all trying to craft radically different accounts of the past. And for me, there was a combined set of strategies, like both of you. I mean, images figure very centrally in this project. So there are 71 black and white images that are in the text. And there's a lot of archival sources and a lot of archival work that also went in the book. I guess one of the polemical subtitle of this book might be, The Revolution Before Gatsby. So how do we think about that kind of, this kind of revolution of black intimate life that took place at the beginning of the 20th century? And largely I have access to the details of that radical transformation through the monographs of sociologists or through police records or through the rent documents of, philanthropists and settlement workers. But it was a challenge to figure out how to really, to tell the story from the vantage point of the young women themselves. So there's an experiment with narration in the book, and it's a form of close narration that creates an intimacy between author and character. So that was one of the ways I tried to both mine the archival documents but exceed the limits of those documents. I also use photographs and early 20th century cinema to fill out some of the features of life within what I describe as the black city within the city. So there are these exercises in ekphrasis. How do you translate images and visuals into words to build stories? And I also include archival documents themselves, so we have a trace of the materiality of the archive that's also reproduced in the book.
Mm-hmm. You should go next.
Well, I want to say that I was trained originally as a sociologist in New York City, and about are talking about the gaze of sociology. And even as a graduate student in the 1990s, I remember saying to a professor that I was interested in studying race and race relations, and he said to me, "We'll go to Harlem." And I said, "But I didn't mention what race I was talking about." So it became, for me as a student, I was pursuing looking at whiteness actually as a racial construct. And so my dissertation was actually comparing how mixed race kids were classified in colonial Virginia versus colonial Cuba, because you can see a really different, interesting story there. So that was my area. But then I was really lucky after graduate school to land a job at Virginia State University here in Petersburg. And so I had this courses that I taught every semester. I taught world history to 1500, US history, Latin American history, Atlantic world history, and every semester I'd read the books that were coming out and the papers or do a research project. And I have to say, unlike you all, who I think are doing things out of whole cloth, I mean, I'm standing on, my bibliography is 30 pages. I'm standing on the shoulders of scholarship that's been happening for centuries. So I kept coming across examples of men and women of African descent who really went against this old narrative of, you know, it's all about plantation slavery only in the American South, only in the 19th century, cut to the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. I was finding these examples of individuals who were doing really extraordinary things. So a little bit was in the archives, but really most of it is collecting information. Like I was referring to the American Revolution, the Patriots today. William C. Nell, a black Bostonian, was writing about this in the 1840s and 50s in Boston. And after that, there were black men and women who were continuing to create this body of knowledge. And then in the 20th century, there's men and women of every background contributing to this body of knowledge. So for me, I'm a synthesizer. I have put together in one place these threads that hundreds of scholars have been, this information has been right under our noses this whole time. Just to give one quick example, back to the American Revolution. So I mentioned James Armistead, who was an enslaved person who worked as a double agent, who is granted his freedom ultimately, and has General Lafayette, recommends his freedom. So Virginia passes a statute, the Commonwealth passes a statute in the wake of the revolution to free enslaved veterans in 1783. And the wording of the statute, which you can Google, I mean, it's in the digitized UVA library, it's right there on the internet. And the act says, the Commonwealth said, because of these individuals' contributions to the establishment of liberty and independence of America. In other words, even the colonial state, this is a commonwealth and a federal state, but my point is, like, even in the records of the authorities, they were recognizing the contributions of these individuals. And just finally to close out, same with the Stono Revolt. The Stono Revolt precedes the American Revolution. When South Carolina made their official records of the revolt from 1739, they said these individuals were chanting the word liberty, and they were fighting for their life and their liberty. So again, all I've done is take stuff that's been kind of around us the whole time and try to put it into one place.
Mm-hmm. Similar to what both of you previously stated, when I started writing these poems, I purposely did incorporate archives because I believe in what both of these women are saying, but what Deb Willis, who is the foremost scholar in African-American photography, has taught me, and is that when a black woman reclaims an archive, she's wrestling it out of the hands of visual empiricisms. So in the history of black women, photographs have been used most often to demonize us, either in anthropological sciences or in terms of other research in terms of criminality. And so by reclaiming the archive and reclaiming these images, I get to create a different script. But also incorporating the archives is a type of curation. I paid in upwards of $1,500 to have some of these photographs that are in the book, incorporated in the book, because I did not want to re-inscribe any historical legacy to these women being fettered and bound in this book. It was important not to do that. And so because I wanted images that did not show these women bound,
I had to pay before the book was even published. So initially, I wrote the praise song, and it was the poem, and it was interspersed with photos, and I had all of the historical references in the back. During the editing process, more than two people came back to me, and they talked about how they were flipping back and forth in the book, and the flipping back and forth was a type of distraction. And that's how we came up with this current structure of the image, the history that I try to write in a Black woman's vernacular. Because I want it to be a type of currency among Black women and gossip that is a very valued communication. And it shows love, disdain, and the emotional aspects of the story rendered. And then the praise song. But this book is also a demonstration of 21st century practices known as remix. Because we live in the age of digital archives, I have nearly a limitless sandbox of creativity. And so I am sampling history in the form of visual images. I'm sampling history in the form of narratives, and I'm laying my own lyrical content on top of that. So, you know, sometimes I call myself a literary DJ, but you know, yeah.
Okay, it looks like we're almost out of time, so unless anybody has like a burning question, then we're gonna do the book signing. So thank you again for coming.
Thank you for everybody coming out in this weather.
Thank you.
And so I guess if you wanna come in the back and sign, I don't know.